From NPR and WBUR, I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
And I'm Robin Young in Boston. It's Here and Now. And today, President Biden made an urgent plea to world leaders gathering in Glasgow, Scotland for COP26, the UN's 26th annual climate summit. His message? Well, it's been 26 years. Is the U.S. ready to get serious on climate change?
It's simple. Will we act? Will we do what is necessary? Will we seize the enormous opportunity before us? Or will we condemn future generations to suffer?
Biden faces an uphill battle in convincing other nations that the U.S. can deliver on its promises. NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow is in Glasgow. Hi, Scott.
Hey, good afternoon.
And start with Biden's speech. What more did he say?
There's a lot of the themes that we've been hearing Biden talk about for a while when it comes to climate, trying to reframe this as something that can add jobs, add to the economy, not a topic of sacrifice that would drastically change the people's lives. Of course, it's probably a mix of both. A few things stuck out to me. He did address the fact that over and over again, the U.S. has come to conferences like this, made big promises, and then not followed through on those promises. He said, "I know it hasn't been the case. My administration is working to show our climate commitment is action, not words." Then later at a side session, Biden outright apologized for the fact that the Trump administration had pulled out of the Paris Climate Agreement in 2015. That's something that his administration rejoined almost immediately after Biden became president. He addressed that. He's trying to make the case that he's serious. But of course, as we've been talking about, the big climate package, the $500 billion plus in funding for climate initiatives, still has not passed Congress. And that makes this talk a challenge.
Well, and so much, how much credibility does Biden have?
I think, you know, something that Biden and administration officials say over and over here in Glasgow and at the G20 summit in Rome over the weekend is that the world wants America at the table. The world wants America to take a lead. I think that's certainly the case. But look, I think there's some skepticism. And as the day has gone on, you've been hearing developing countries speak. And you can hear a little bit of frustration saying that, you know, the Western world, the countries like the U.S. that historically have been the biggest emitters are making all these calls, not following through, at the same time asking them to make drastic sacrifices and eliminate coal. There's a lot more coal in places like India than there is in the United States right now. So I think there's a little bit of skepticism about the U.S., both Biden's ability to follow up his promises with action in Congress, and also what could come next if, you know, when Biden isn't president anymore.
Well, you mentioned that G20 summit in Rome, and yesterday he did, as you say, he's trying to strike a positive tone on the U.S. role. Let's listen.
We got significant support here, significant support. We're the most, the United States of America is the most critical part of this entire agenda, and we did it.
But you mentioned skepticism, Scott, and leaders at that summit did not make major strides on climate. So he seems to be two tracks here, his positivity.
That's right.
And, yeah, what's happening.
That's right. Despite what Biden and what John Kerry, his top climate envoy, were saying about the agreement that came out of G20, a lot of world leaders are criticizing that today. This was a gathering of the 20 richest countries in the world, and they released a statement on climate that really just boiled down to statements and promises countries have already made. There was an agreement to stop financing coal-powered plants in other countries, but no agreement, no commitment for these countries to say we are going to stop using coal to power our own economies. Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, really criticized that as tepid. On one hand, these climate promises coming from things like the G20 are much further than countries have agreed to before. On the other hand, it is nowhere near enough what scientists say is absolutely needed in order to head off the worst of climate change. So the goal here in Scotland is to extract more specific, more aggressive promises, but that's going to be tough, especially because, as I think we've mentioned already, China is not here, and China is the world's biggest carbon emitter right now.
Yeah. Got about a minute, Scott. There you are in Glasgow. What is the sense there? I mean, it sounds pretty depressing right now, but what is the sense? I mean, and what is the sense on the streets? Are there protesters? What's happening?
I will confess, I will be in Glasgow tomorrow. I am currently in Edinburgh, far away from Glasgow, but I arrived with the White House reporters in the middle of the night last night, so we'll be there tomorrow. But Frank Langford and Dan Charles, our colleagues who are on the scene, say that's exactly right. The protesters surrounding, the activists surrounding the site are fed up. They're tired of promises, decades and decades of promises from world leaders and largely empty rhetoric. They're saying there need to be aggressive, real sacrifices and specific promises made at this conference, or it'll be a failure.
NPR White House correspondent Scott Detrow. We will be following all of his travels in the next few days. Scott, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Back in this country, the Supreme Court today heard arguments about the bitterly contested Texas abortion law. The law bans the procedure after about 6 weeks of pregnancy and is the nation's most restrictive. It was also designed to avoid legal challenge, so this case is a big test. Michelle Oberman is a professor at Santa Clara University School of Law. Her research focuses on reproductive health issues, and she joins us now. Welcome. And first of all, what is the real-life impact of this Texas law?
So the real-life impact of the law is to make it so that somebody who is pregnant in Texas and does not want to have a baby has to figure out an alternative, which will involve traveling out of state. And so in the weeks since September 1st, since the law went into effect, thousands of people have had to scrape together money and daycare and call in favors and then generally time to get the distance from where they live in Texas to nearby neighboring states where they're able to get a legal abortion.
Right. And you write and study about the cost of abortion in the U.S. and elsewhere. Is that, you think, a key implication here in Texas and perhaps eventually in other states is it is just raising the costs for women asking this question?
In the short run, it is extraordinarily expensive for people who are newly confronting an unwanted pregnancy and trying to figure out how to go about ending it. In the longer run, what we know from countries around the world with restrictive abortion laws is that people are going to figure out ways to quickly and safely end an unwanted pregnancy, largely by accessing abortion medications, which are widely available for purchase online. So while the law was a big surprise, I think, for many people on the pro-choice abortion rights side, it seems absolutely clear that within a matter of certainly short years, if not months, we'll have systems on the ground that provide access to abortion medicines, just like they do in places like El Salvador, where it's completely illegal to have an abortion under any circumstances.
Now, here in Washington, of course, the Supreme Court this morning heard oral arguments in this very complicated Texas case. How does what happens in the Supreme Court interact with this reality on the ground you're describing?
I'm so glad you asked that question. So at the technical level, if the Supreme Court was to enjoin Texas's law, then we would have a brief reprieve while the Supreme Court allows the process to work its way through on the constitutionality of a law that has the effect of and the intent of limiting a constitutionally protected right. And so we'll ultimately get, whether it's in this case or in the Mississippi case, Dobbs, which is coming up next month, we'll ultimately get a fuller opinion on whether this newly composed Supreme Court will vote to uphold Roe versus Wade or will vote to restrict or even to overturn a person's right to abortion.
And what would the implications be on the ground if the Texas law is allowed to stand?
So if the Texas law is allowed to stand, or even if the Mississippi law is allowed to overturn Roe versus Wade, the effects on the ground will be a short-term market frenzy. The same if you want to imagine how the United States looks when we passed prohibition. What I mean to suggest is that what happened in the wake of prohibition is that the demand for alcohol found a way to generate a new market. And it took a little while. There was a drop-off in alcohol consumption. I don't know that we'll see a few years of a drop-off in abortion following any federal decision allowing states to recriminalize abortion, because around half of the states will continue to have legalized abortion. So folks with money will be able to get in cars and on planes and on buses and make their way to states where abortion is legal if what they want is a surgical abortion with a doctor. The other thing, though, that is really important to bear in mind is that abortion drugs are widely available. There are websites like Plan C or Women on Web that advertise these sales that are shipping already into the United States. We've seen in the past 10 years an uptick in the number of people presenting for care in clinics. And so we're very unlikely to see the sort of results that I imagine Texans who support the law wanted to see, which is that a lot of folks envision a world in which people are compelled to carry their pregnancies and then surrender them for adoption by couples who want those babies. That reality has not been borne out in countries around the world, and there's really no reason to believe that that's the reality we're going to see here, even if Texas and Mississippi have their way.
Michelle Oberman is law professor at Santa Clara University. Her book is Her Body, Our Laws, on the Front Lines of the Abortion War from El Salvador to Oklahoma. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
The Virginia governor's race ends tomorrow. Both candidates piled into buses for whistle-stop tours of the state in the final days. Democrat Terry McAuliffe kicked off his in Arlington, Virginia, just across the river from D.C.
How about that bus? Gonna have some fun on that bus, everybody.
And Republican Glenn Youngkin had a bus he encouraged supporters to sign further west in Great Falls, Virginia.
Let's go sign the bus. Let's go sign the bus. Here we go. Bless you all.
Now, we caught up with their supporters at two of these events. You'll hear a little bit more of them in a minute. But first, let's bring in Harry Wilson, senior political analyst at Roanoke College. Harry, how are you?
Doing well. How are you today, Scott?
I'm great. Now, both candidates here have heavyweights in their corner. Terry McAuliffe campaigned with President Biden. Glenn Youngkin has Donald Trump's endorsement. Roanoke College just has a new poll. Is that right? What are you seeing?
In our last poll, which was released on Saturday, we have Terry McAuliffe up by one, which means essentially this is statistically tied, as people say, but it's certainly well within our margin of error.
And how did this race get so tight? In the last decade, Virginia in statewide races, national races, has increasingly been turning blue, not now.
Well, I think what this is really is an enthusiasm difference. Democrats were strongly motivated 4 years ago in 2017 to turn out after Donald Trump took the White House in 2016. And this time around, I think their motivation is lower, and Republicans are highly motivated because of Democrats having control of not just the governor's mansion in Virginia, but the General Assembly, and the fact that the Democratic Party in Virginia and policy has moved pretty far to the left in the past 4 years. So I think what we're seeing here is Republicans really motivated, and we saw that in our poll. They were had a 17-point gap in terms of being very or extremely enthusiastic for about voting.
Republican Glenn Youngkin has campaigned a lot, as you know, on parents and education, and so many people we spoke to on the trail mentioned this, like college student Sean Lasik.
When it comes to the school board, he's trying to get rid of the critical race theory, which is a big problem. Definitely trying to get kids back into school, not having them wear those masks, hopefully.
Now, critical race theory is an academic theory that's in law school. I should say that when I spoke to these voters about critical race theory, they understood it as simply being a divisive way of talking about race in schools. And Amy Lutz, mother of seven, said that Zoom school during the pandemic really opened parents' eyes.
The fact that you really got to see what your children were learning and not what they would come home and say, oh, this is what's happening. Because some parents would go, oh, yeah, well, that's just teachers, or maybe you misheard. Or so parents then got, you know, like eyes open, like, whoa, wait a minute. This is not what I'm paying my tax dollars for. This is not why I'm sending my children here. I mean, we know a lot of people that decided to come home and homeschool them because they're like, you know what? We're not doing this.
Harry, how did education become such a hot button issue in this race?
Well, I think the critical race theory has been an issue certainly in Virginia and nationally for some time. But in Virginia, I think it's been it's really become a hot button issue. And then the question of who controls what students are learning, as the voters you just spoke to sort of demonstrate, I think that parents in some ways now, some people are becoming more involved and paying more attention to what their kids are learning. And some people are disagreeing with some of what's being taught. There's a question in our poll. We saw there was a big difference between Democrats and Republicans in terms of who they thought should be controlling curriculum. Democrats much more likely to say teachers and administrators, and Republicans much more likely right now to say parents. Big differences there. So it's a question of really sort of who's controlling what children are learning. And that is obviously an important issue. And it's also became important because of that second gubernatorial debate where Terry McAuliffe either said or misspoke, depending on which side you're on, about parents shouldn't have no influence in terms of what their kids are taught.
I don't think parents should be telling schools what they should teach.
Yeah, and we've been seeing that played on a loop here in Virginia in these Youngkin political ads. Could this issue of parents and education be a national issue for GOP candidates, you think, in the midterms outside of Virginia?
Oh, I think absolutely it could be, yes. This is an important issue for Republicans because this is one where they may be able to win back some of those suburban voters that they lost because of Donald Trump. And it's part of the reason why Glenn Youngkin has been trying to keep Donald Trump essentially as far away from Virginia as he can, because he knows that Trump doesn't play well in those suburbs. And that's why Republicans lost in 2016 and 17 and 20. And Republicans need to get those folks back.
Now let's talk about the Democrat, Terry McAuliffe, former governor of Virginia, running for another term, separated by a few years. On the McAuliffe side, he is trying to link Youngkin to Donald Trump. On the campaign trail, we heard McAuliffe's team talk about Trump in khakis or Trumpkin. Here's how one of McAuliffe's supporters, Miru Korinha, put it.
There's a real sense that Glenn Youngkin is just Trump, but, you know, not as harsh, not as vulgar. He, instead of having a red hat, he has his little red vest.
He does wear a fleece vest on the trail. Is this tactic of connecting Youngkin to Trump, do you think it's working?
Well, that certainly is what Terry McAuliffe has tried to do. You might think he's running against Donald Trump as opposed to running against Glenn Youngkin. And he's doing that because Trump doesn't poll well in Virginia. You know, he lost Virginia in 16 and 20. Whether that's going to be enough, that's kind of difficult because people do understand Donald Trump is really not on the ballot.
One other issue we heard several Democratic voters talk about is abortion and voting rights. Let's take a listen to Terry McAuliffe supporter Carol Handlin.
As long as the media continues to keep a woman's rights and the Republican view of that in the headlines, it will continue to be an influence. Having the right attorney general and the right leadership in that regard is important to me.
The McAuliffe voters we spoke to pointed to abortion restrictions in Texas especially. How are these issues outside the state playing here in Virginia?
I think those issues are important. Part of McAuliffe's strategy has been to call attention to those issues and, you know, and to argue that Virginia will, you know, if Youngkin is elected, then Virginia will become like Texas. And again, the you know, policy in the Commonwealth for the past 4 years, Democrats have moved the Commonwealth of Virginia pretty far to the left since they really gained control of the General Assembly and Governor's Mansion. You know, there are a lot of questions there regarding a lot of different issues.
Now, if the Virginia Governor State House indeed turns red, right, after a decade of the state becoming bluer, what would the significance be for the rest of the country?
I think it would be a blueprint. Even if Youngkin would lose a very, very close election, I think this could show Republicans nationally, you know, like, hey, you can do well by trying to keep some of Trump's policies, but keep Trump away. Obviously, there's some places in the country where you want to bring Trump in, where he did well, but there are other places like Virginia where you simply don't. Trump lost a lot of Republicans due to his demeanor, I think, not due necessarily to his policies. And again, those are the people that Youngkin and other Republicans have to get back. And if they don't get those people back, they don't win elections. So they have to find a way to do that without fully embracing Trump, which is difficult to do when Trump is injecting himself into politics on a daily basis still.
Yeah. Finally, let's come back to this critical issue of turnout, as you described, right? These are not election years where people are turning out across the country. This is just Virginia, so turnout is going to be really important. Youngkin's camp says they are seeing a lot of enthusiasm. Let's take a listen again to Amy Lutz.
I will tell you, I've never seen so many, especially Republican signs. Never, never. And I think, like I said, I think people are finally like, you know what? We've got to make a change.
And here's McAuliffe supporter Rebecca Leet on the Democratic side.
I'm worried about turnout. I'm worried about the Democratic turnout because this is a turnout race. Whoever turns out the most people is going to win. We did great last year. on the presidential election, but if people don't turn out, it's, you know, we're not going to win.
So, Harry Wilson, any final thoughts on turnout on the eve of this vote?
I would say those folks really nailed the issue. This election really is about turnout and both sides trying to get as many of their voters out to the polls as they can possibly get. And Republicans, I would expect to be motivated now the same way Democrats were in 2017, because Republicans have lost. And losing an election really motivates people to get out the next time. You know, I mean, if we look at different models, if at the end, you know, it's Democrats plus three, meaning 3% more Democrats in the electorate. So the electorate might be 43% Democratic, 40% Republican, and 17% Independent. The percentages there were much greater in favor of the Democrats in 2017, that it was something like 40% Democratic, 30% Republican. If we see that tomorrow, then Terry McAuliffe wins in a romp. And I don't think anyone's expecting to see that this time. So if we see something like, say, 35% Democrat, 33% Republican, there's a pretty strong possibility that Youngkin can win. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what I mean in terms of who's turning out. And it really is becomes a turnout election. If you can get your people out there to vote, then, you know, you're likely to win. And we saw that with all the heavy hitters that Terry McAuliffe brought into the Commonwealth in the past week and a half, 2 weeks. President Biden, former President Obama, Stacey Abrams, Cory Booker, everybody who's anybody in the Democratic Party, because McAuliffe is so well connected. So he's really doing whatever he can to get turnout on the Democratic side as high as he possibly can.
All right, that is Harry Wilson, senior political analyst at Roanoke College. Harry, thanks for the time.
Thank you, Scott. It's a pleasure.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from BetterHelp Online Therapy, making professional therapy accessible, affordable, and convenient. BetterHelp offers licensed therapists who specialize in issues including depression and anxiety, as well as relationships, trauma, anger, and more. Connect privately with your therapist through live chat, phone, or video calls. Get help on your own time and pace, and at an affordable rate. For 10% off your first month of online therapy, visit betterhelp.com/hereandnow.
Jury selection is underway today in the trial of Kyle Rittenhouse, who shot and killed two men and wounded another last summer at a protest in Kenosha, Wisconsin, after the police shooting of a black man named Jacob Blake Jr. Rittenhouse, 17 at the time, claims self-defense. Chuck Kornbach of member station WUWM has this report and a warning. There is the sound of gunshots, and it may be difficult for some listeners.
On August 23rd of last year, Rustin Shesky, a white Kenosha police officer, was responding to a domestic incident before he eventually shot and severely wounded Jacob Blake Jr. The shooting touched off intense protests, and several businesses were burned down. 2 days after Blake was shot, then 17-year-old Kyle Rittenhouse, who lives in northern Illinois, went to Kenosha, partly to, as he claims, help citizen militia members protect other businesses near downtown. That night, after law enforcement used tear gas and armored vehicles to force Black Lives Matter protesters away from the county courthouse, a few demonstrators interacted with Rittenhouse, who was armed with an AR-15-style rifle, provided by an adult friend. Rittenhouse begins firing, as you can hear in this video from journalist Brendan Guttenschwanger. Rittenhouse shot and killed two men, Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber, and a third man, Gage Grosskreutz, was wounded. Prosecutors have charged Rittenhouse with homicide and other crimes. He claims he shot the men in self-defense. Conservative groups helped pay his $2 million bail. Last week, a contentious pretrial hearing brought up several issues. One was whether to introduce video evidence of law enforcement telling Rittenhouse and other militia members before the shootings that their presence was appreciated. Defense attorney Corey Schirafisi argued in favor of it, saying the remarks influenced Rittenhouse's actions.
And when he has conversations with police officers and they let him go about his business. And when the police say things like they've said on that tape, those go to his state of mind.
Kenosha County Assistant District Attorney Thomas Binger responded that the police comments to Rittenhouse are not relevant.
The police assessment of the defendant prior to him killing two people does not have any bearing on whether or not his actions in shooting and killing two people were lawful or reckless or not.
But Circuit Judge Bruce Schrader says he'll probably rule the video is admissible. The judge made another controversial ruling in saying that the dead and wounded men cannot be referred to during the trial as victims, but can be called rioters or arsonists. In the mostly white city of Kenosha, residents are still split over a prosecutor's decision not to bring charges against the police officer who wounded Jacob Blake. And residents are also divided on the Rittenhouse case. Robert Hune, who is white, says he has sympathy for the accused.
I mean, I understand what he maybe was thinking, what he was doing. Shooting people that, you know, if you're being attacked, I understand that.
But Arlita Pledger, who is black, says Rittenhouse should face the same punishment she believes a black man would get.
I just feel like when you take two people's lives and say that it was a black man, he would have got put to jail. So, like, you need to treat people equally.
Lawyers in the Rittenhouse case say the trial could last at least 2 weeks. For Here and Now, I'm Chuck Quernbach in Milwaukee.
The COVID vaccines have been a remarkable success. According to the CDC, more than 221 million people in the U.S. are fully vaccinated, and serious adverse reactions are extremely rare. For instance, just 238 of the more than 15 million Americans who got the Johnson & Johnson shot came down with Guillain-Barré syndrome, or GBS, which tricks the immune system into attacking nerve cells. Anthony Flint is one of the 238 who got GBS back in April. But he hasn't talked about it till recently, and the reason is thought-provoking. Anthony is with the nonprofit Lincoln Institute of Land Policy. They focus on sustainable land use. Anthony, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
And let's just jump right in. You do recommend the vaccines.
Yes. Even as I get around with a cane, I still recommend that everyone get the COVID vaccine.
You write, there's more risk from COVID, but also more risk from getting in a car every day. Than, let's say, having an adverse side effect.
Yes, I really wrestled with telling my story, but I think that the best outcome here is to just stand back and look at what the actual risks are of something bad happening.
Well, and we want to do that. I want to talk about GBS and what happened to you. But this fact that you had an adverse side effect made it more difficult for you to talk about what happened to you with the vaccine, because you do support the vaccines. Have I got that right?
Yes. You know, this is scary stuff. I've learned more about GBS than I ever thought I would, and it's pretty fascinating, actually, medically. But it's been hard for me to talk about because I didn't see how it would fit into, you know, such a fraught dialogue about vaccines and vaccine hesitation. I'm normally a serial social media poster, but I held back because I was worried it would scare people away from the vaccines who were, you know, had genuine questions. Also that it might be kind of like hijacked by anti-vax disinformation campaigns.
Right. You don't want to be lumped in with people who think vaccines cause infertility. They don't, or that they have something to do with microchips. They don't. That was your fear. Well, obviously, you think we should talk about it now. What are we talking about? Guillain-Barré syndrome, named after two French doctors who noticed kind of a paralysis in World War I soldiers. It can be caused by virus, by bacteria, bad food, other vaccines. Very small risk. But what is it? What did it do to you? What did you feel, and when did you feel it?
Well, the first pangs came after a mere 20-minute ride on a stationary bike at the gym. And then I had trouble sleeping. I had this funny feeling underneath my skin, like champagne bubbles. I went to the emergency room actually a couple of times before getting a spinal tap and having the diagnosis of GBS. And what I was told is that something goes haywire. Our immune systems are amazing things, but my antibodies confronted the spike protein represented by the J&J vaccine. But then some of them started looking around and they decided that the coating on my nerves, on my peripheral nervous system, also kind of looked like that. And they decided that they should go ahead and attack that as if it was an enemy. So it was my body attacking my own peripheral nervous system.
I mean, you describe it in an essay you wrote for the Boston Globe magazine. They went rogue and they took the hill, you know, only the hill was you. And you're treated with fresh antibodies. Those rogue antibodies, those misinformed troops, were sucked out through a tube in your neck. It's a pretty tough case.
It's been quite a journey. Three treatments, following up with steroids to sort of tamp down the lingering inflammation. But the hard work really comes with rehab. And for that, I went to Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. And first of all, I have to say, I'm very grateful I'm grateful for a lot of things. One is to have health insurance and understanding employer, but to be in the medical epicenter of Boston. I was treated at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, and then I went to Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. And there, I had to learn how to walk all over again and to use my hands and get on the path to recovery.
Yeah, it's pretty brutal.
Yeah, I was flat on my back, easily fatigued. At first, I was getting around only with a walker, also a wheelchair.
In July, you say you were watching when the CDC announced the warning about Guillain-Barré syndrome tied to the Johnson & Johnson shot, and you wept. Why?
And, you know, this confirmed what my doctors had told me. I felt bad for the other 100 people. It was 100 people at the time. And it really just hit home that I just got so extremely unlucky. And then that night, I remember watching all the national news and seeing how the media treated the story. And it was pretty uniform. And it was that, here's this terrible thing that happened. The FDA attached a warning, but it's very rare. And just about everybody said the things that we're saying, which was that, you know, the risks of getting COVID are much greater. Mm-hmm. And the vaccines are, for the most part, safe and effective.
Well, you know, you and I spoke. We wrestled about how do we do this? We want to make sure that the headline is that the vaccines still work and that this is rare. But as I just did that again, that kind of ignores what you went through. I mean, that must have made you feel really lonely and diminished. I mean, people were saying things like, oh, it's just a weakness.
Right, yes. I remember thinking, you know, I'll show you weakness. I remember I had to go lie down after reading that. I also felt like, hey, come on, let's not gloss over anything either. You know, you can talk about the percentages, but as my doctor once said, you know, this is 100% of me. Mm. I was sort of wrestling with that feeling of wanting to be acknowledged about the hard thing that happened and just having a more reasonable conversation
right.
about it.
It's lonely.
Yeah, I longed to talk about my rehab sessions in the gym there at Spalding, but I held back because it was just too supercharged. Through social media in particular.
So it was isolating for you, but you also worry about the message it sends.
Yeah, ultimately, that's what I decided was I should tell my story because we shouldn't try to hide any of this. It'll look like the medical establishment is trying to hide something if they don't talk about adverse effects, however rare. Let's put all the cards on the table. Yes, something goes haywire in the very small number of people, and then you can move on to the overwhelming majority of cases where there are no such adverse effects. But I think there are people out there who have genuine questions about the vaccines and how they work and what happens in their bodies or their kids' bodies.
Well, you say those people, they can handle the truth. And I'm thinking as well, it allows, you know, the 200 or so of people like you who have GBS, rare, but they're not so isolated. They can get some more support maybe as well.
I sometimes wonder, you know, who those other people are. I'd actually really like to get in touch with some of them. One of the great things that Beth Israel did actually was connect me with another GBS patient who has since recovered. And it was great to talk about. It was almost like a support group.
Yeah.
I think the greater good was really to confront side effects more honestly and openly for anyone who is hesitating, although it also has the effect, as you say, of making us feel a little less alone.
Anthony Flint of Boston, somebody who's had a side effect, Guillain-Barré syndrome from the Johnson & Johnson COVID vaccine, one of the very few who have had that reaction. And by the way, Anthony, when might you expect recovery? What are you hearing?
They say that it's usually 6 months to a year. 80% of GBS patients have a full recovery. I am just hoping and having my fingers crossed that next spring I'll experience that full recovery. Horrible experience, interesting issues. I've learned a lot, and I keep learning and keep trying to get better.
Thank you so much, and we wish you the best.
All right, thank you.
So, Anthony mentioned he'd love to meet others with GBS. If that's you, send us a note, letters@hearnow.org.
Baristas in Buffalo, New York may be on their way to forming the first ever union at a corporate-owned Starbucks. The National Labor Relations Board ruled that three stores in the Buffalo area can hold separate elections, and they start next week. Matthew Bodie is a former attorney with the National Board. He now teaches law at St. Louis University. And he spoke to our colleague, Here and Now's Tanya Mosley.
There are now over 9,000 corporate-run Starbucks locations in the country, but not one has a union. How significant is this effort to unionize?
Whenever you have a unionization effort at a big brand like Starbucks, it definitely makes the news. And if these stores were to unionize, that would really be a kind of a dramatic change, certainly for Starbucks, but also for a lot of other big branded companies that are also not unionized, where there have been some efforts over the years, but nothing really substantially successful beyond the big brands like GM and Ford that have been traditionally been unionized for many, many years.
Mm-hmm. Starbucks announced that all of its hourly workers in the U.S. will make at least $15 an hour. This comes at this time with these union talks. How else is the company trying to respond to the unionization efforts?
Well, it looks like that the initial efforts were to really put a focus on these stores, try and figure out if there were things that the workers were upset about. There were reports of high-level management, including the president of Starbucks North America, coming to visit and paying attention to the workers, listening to the workers, trying to figure out what's going on. I think there's an image of the president cleaning up, mopping a floor, right? So to kind of show not only that they're interested in what's going on, but also that they're all part of the same team and they all want to work together to make Starbucks a better place. So some of the more unusual things are having high-level managers come, not just for like a quick drive-by, but I believe one of the logs for one of the stores had the president coming seven times, which I think that's pretty unusual for someone, again, who's in charge of 9,000 stores in the United States and also stores in Canada. To spend so much time at one location is pretty unusual.
So all of this is happening now, but previous union campaigns within Starbucks have failed in the past. In one instance, two baristas in Philadelphia were fired for trying to unionize. I bring this up because I'm talking about the way that the company is responding to these calls for unionization. Does this speak to how hard it is to actually start a union within Starbucks?
It's really hard to start a union at any big company these days, particularly in the service industry. There are a lot of tools that companies can use dissuade employees. You know, some are illegal, right? Firing a worker because they're in support of a union is definitely illegal. And the National Labor Relations Board has the authority to order those workers to get back pay and be rehired by the company. But there are a lot of legal tools as well, including closed-door meetings, to explain to the workers why management thinks that it's a bad idea to join the union, how it'll change the environment at the company. And Starbucks in particular has, I think, tried to cultivate an image of a very progressive company, one that is more worker-oriented, more worker-friendly, There have been some benefits, including educational benefits and healthcare benefits, that are a little unusual in the industry. Starbucks calls its employees partners. I think those efforts are designed to try and make employees feel like they're all part of the same team or same family, and by doing so, discourage, you know, bringing in quote-unquote outsiders that the union would represent.
Mm-hmm. I mean, to be more explicit about this, though, the New York Times reported that Starbucks increased staff and shut down stores for training. They've also sent in support managers from out of state. Starbucks has denied that all of this has anything to do with counteracting union efforts. But are they trying to work against workers who want a union?
Yeah, that's the interesting thing. I mean, ultimately, it should be up to the workers to decide whether they want to be represented by a union. It's really their choice, because their relationship is with the union, and then the union then would have a relationship with the employer in representing those employees. But it's really been cast as kind of, instead of voting yes or no for the union, you're voting for the union or you're voting for the company. And the company kind of wants to kind of cast it that way, because I think most workers, you know, even though they may complain about their jobs on a day-to-day basis, I think a lot of workers are proud of where they work. They want to do a good job, and they want to see themselves as part of a larger group that's working towards, you know, some higher purpose, even if that's really good coffee, right? So the kind of claim that you're being disloyal, or the kind of indication that you're not part of the team if you want to bring in a union, I think can be very effective in kind of dissuading some employees in the instance. Now, as you mentioned, some of the things they've done, including bringing in high-level management, staffing up stores. I think there was one report that there were like 9 baristas behind the bar of a very, not very crowded Starbucks one morning, closing 2 stores. Now, the company has reallocated those workers from those stores to other places. But anytime you actually close one of the units that is petitioning to have a union there, that definitely raises red flags for me as a former NLRB attorney and someone who, you know, works in this area. That was surprising, along with those high-level managers coming, and that, as you mentioned, the huge increase in staffing at some of the stores.
That's Matthew Bode, professor of law at St. Louis University. Matthew, thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Scott Tong in Washington, D.C.
I'm Robin Young in Boston. This is Here and Now.